trouble. Put your helmet on, we'll be heading for a fall. Yeah, the whole thing's gonna blow. And the devil's got my number. It's long overdue, he'll come looking soon. Yeah, the whole thing's gonna blow.
To sing, you must first open your mouth. You must have a pair of lungs and a little knowledge of music. It is not necessary to have an accordion or a guitar. The essential thing is to want to sing. This, then, is a song. I am singing. Henry Miller, Tropic of Cancer.
There is, with any great artist, a little manicness and insanity. Tropic of Cancer is one of my favorite books, and author Henry Miller had this work ethic, where he would get out of bed every day and force himself to write 5 pages. It taught me that if you do the work, you progress. So many people are content to settle. My dad was exceptionally ambitious, but he had a lot thrown on him exceeding his ambition. He wanted his band to be successful, but he didn't want to be the fucking voice of a generation. Francis Bean Cobain.
For many years, I've said that I'm an artist not by choice, but because I have no choice. The truth is, I'm not even sure what the hell that means. It just helps me to explain my art practice, which I've never known life without. Some of my earliest memories are of Saturday morning spent in front of the TV, hurrying to draw cartoon characters before the credits rolled. And I had to wait a week to see them again. No VCR, you know. As a bored youth on the prairies in central Canada, I would foster my curious mind by exploring the unknown. That may be one reason why I grew up numb to everything but chaos, chance, and taboo. Hello and good morning. I am William Morgan, and this is 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com. A weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our day. You can find us online at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail@42minutes.com. You can also follow our tweets at Sync42 and at SyncBook. It's Tuesday, the 14th day of April, and this is our 180th broadcast. Today we are headed up to the Canadian Plains to consider art, science, and religion.
But first, let's reconnect with SyncBook Radio and find out what's been going on. I hope that you're all aware that we launched our member section. Well, if not, know that after a soft launch with continued systems testing, we are not only confident that the system is optimized, but we're also amazed at the way the site has taken on a new life of its own. If you've ever wanted to be part of helping with the great content you've come to expect from SyncBook, now is the time to become a member. Some of the membership benefits include full access to SyncBook Radio's complete audio archive of over 600 hours, discounts on books and publications, exclusive podcasts, and exclusive videos, as well as monthly online hangouts with the hosts. And all this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com/membership. And speaking of the monthly hangouts, so far we've done 2 of these, and they really are becoming something special, one of the best things we do each month. What we're learning is that our members are fascinating, creative, and eager to share their sync practices, and thus these are becoming something more like a symposium or a sync tank. It's a wonderful time, and the only thing missing is your voice. Then our next hangout is Monday, April 20th, and this one's going to be really special. We've got a couple guests lined up to give a short talk that it's going to be something. In other news, Marty Leeds has a big summer tour schedule he will be embarking upon shortly and for which he needs to prepare, and thus after one more scheduled Mathemagical Radio Hour, his show will go into summer hiatus. Look for him in Canada on the Modern Knowledge Tour. Information about the Modern Knowledge Tour can be found at modernknowledge.ca, and all things Marty Leeds can always be found at martyleeds33.com. What else? The only place to experience the video work of David Plate currently is on Dropbox 42, and I should note that Dropbox 42 is one of the perks of the SyncBook Plus yearly membership.
It's big.
Option it's 64. Big. There's lots of great shows coming from 42 Minutes, so stay tuned and look to Facebook for details. Pentimental also has a really inspiring guest list in the wings. Nice work, John. And SyncBook Press has a couple of books in early production. The SyncBook.com is, oh yeah, this is something. The SyncBook.com is exploring the idea of hosting another summit next spring. It's just in the brainstorming phase right now, but if you have any thoughts or ideas or something you'd like, be sure and send us a note if you'd like to participate and whatnot. So mail at 42minutes.com or contact at thesyncbook.com. That's enough. What are we doing today, Mr. William Morgan?
That's right. That's enough. I'm cutting you off. Today we have the pleasure of sharing 42 Minutes with Darcy J. Watt, artist, printmaker, and psychonaut syncad. He is a left-handed colorblind professional who works from the country near Winnipeg, Canada. Of himself, he states, "My left hand makes art while my third eye studies mythology." Mr. Watt has worked with Ashba Media, yes, and he has graced everything from CD covers to rock posters and band shirts, working with performers ranging from Guns N' Roses and Willie Nelson to Cirque du Soleil. More information about his work can be found at darcyjwatt.com. It's a pleasure to be checking in with Winnipeg this morning. How are you, sir?
Good. Thanks a lot. No, I'm looking forward to this conversation.
I've been looking forward to talking to you for quite a while myself, man. We've been big fans of your work for a while.
It's funny. I was ready to just dive into this, and you guys actually kind of threw me off there when you did the Francis Bean quote there about Kurt Cobain, because just yesterday, I mean, I don't know a lot about Kurt Cobain, except I've always felt like kind of a connection with him. Okay. And my wife was just saying yesterday, she's like, out of nowhere, neither of us are huge fans, but we're just sort of vaguely familiar. She said that I reminded her of Kurt Cobain, and I was like, that's interesting, because wow, I've had a connection. And so that, anyways, it just kind of threw me off that this is an awesome thing to kind of start off this conversation.
Which, so the reason why I included that is just because there was this Rolling Stone piece, a big piece on her, because there's a new film about Kurt Cobain coming out shortly. I think it's been at film festivals, but it's coming out. And I just thought that was super inspiring for her to really root in and say, you know, so many people say they're an artist, but the idea of actually having an artistic practice means that you're doing the work. Mm-hmm. And that for me is something that I need someone kind of beating that over my head.
Right. You actually have to produce.
Well, you actually have to show up.
Exactly.
Every day.
Yeah.
Let's just start there and talk about your practice a little bit.
Well, we live out in the sort of the boonies now. We're in rural Manitoba. And the reason why I wanted to move here was, before that, I spent some time in Los Angeles and kind of like in bigger cities and areas where the art was the focus. And now that I have a family, I wanted to sort of really simplify, because I tend to have a one-track mind, and I wanted to come out here where I could focus on my art practice and not be distracted with all the lights and the events and the things going on, you know? And so this is the first time I've had my own studio space in our home, and it's something that I sort of retreat to keep that practice going. But it's harder when I don't have sort of a sense of artistic community, those other artists to sort of always keep you in the groove of creating and keeping that practice going. So it's much more difficult to constantly create when you're the onus is on you completely without a sense of community, you know?
How far from Winnipeg are you?
I'm about 3 hours from Winnipeg.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And then how rural is this town that you're in?
Well, there's about 1,400 people here, so it's not, I mean, it's not, you know, just I'm not alone by any means, but, and we're actually, I'm closer to the States than I am to Winnipeg. I'm about 10 minutes from the border of North Dakota. So I'm right at the Peace Gardens. It's like I can see the Peace Gardens right.
Oh, I
right
see.
From where I am. Yeah.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I think that he associated you with Winnipeg because of the work you've done on like the Cosmic Tigger and Oso Blanco, right, and everything. Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit on how you got involved with, say, you know, synchromysticism? It obviously has to do with Jim or Jake. Right. But.
Yeah, it was, well, what happened was I just came back from Los Angeles, and I mean, I was sort of all my life growing up in the prairies, I thought that's where, you know, that was my dream. I'm going to make it in Hollywood kind of thing, you know, whatever that was. And then when I got there, I was, a lot of those dreams were crushed. And, because I had a lot of great opportunities there and made some great friends, and I missed that place like crazy. But I also, having your dream shattered was a real life changer for me to come back here and want to, you know, get my shit together and figure out what I really wanted from life. And so I started seeking, like, I went to a Vipassana meditation course, and I was doing that because I was preparing to go to Peru and do ayahuasca. I thought this might help give me a sense of where I should go next, you know?
Why not?
Yeah, I was like, whatever, just go. Yeah, it's all or nothing for me, so let's just do this. And when I was at this Vipassana course, I overheard a guy talking, this older guy talking about doing ayahuasca. And so after the course, I asked him where he went to it. And, you know, because I'm going to, this is what I'm doing, sort of psychologically preparing myself to go to Peru. And he said, well, you don't have to go to Peru. It happens here in Winnipeg. And so that's how I met Jim. He introduced me to Jim. And, you know, that was how we connected there. When was that?
Around what time was that?
That was in 2009.
So is that when you got back? You got back from LA in 2009?
Just in the beginning of 2008, I got back.
Okay.
And how long were you in LA?
I'd been back and forth. I'd kind of road tripped and lived in the car back and forth since I was 19. But it was for most of 2007. I had an opportunity to. MySpace was the big thing, yeah. In like 2006. I put an animated project I was working on. It was like a horror anthology cartoon, and it got the interest of Susie Dieter, who is a director of Futurama and The Simpsons. And so she asked if I would come down and, you know, see if we could develop this together. So I didn't want to miss that opportunity. No. So I sort of just. And I remember the day I just basically threw out all my stuff in the big dumpster in the back and had a backpack and in my vehicle and left, you know. And but it was through that. And I also had it exhibited in Canada with Angus Oblong, who is the creator of the Oblongs, the TV show. And I kind of jumped from couch to couch at Susie's place and Angus's house when I was there for 2007. So I kind of, my experience there was of people who were already doing something there. I wasn't just sort of, you know, I got to go to some really cool parties and be part of good art exhibits and stuff, but it also to see sort of the seedy underbelly of how LA worked, it gives me, it's difficult for me to really appreciate synchromysticism in the way that I see it developing online with a lot of focus on the movies and syncs in there, because like synchronicity, you know, sort of in a Jungian way is absolutely important to me, but to use the framework of Hollywood is difficult for me because, you know,
you've seen the bad side of it.
Yeah, right?
You are in the sausage factory.
Right. It's kind of the same reason why Catholicism isn't really interesting to me when you see the corruption of the Vatican and, you know, stuff like that. It's like, no, I don't. I kind of equate the two in some way, you know, just like I don't want to use that as the framework, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Reaching the. But. But it's funny because I have. You know, Jim and I are friends and but there's never any tension. It's not that that's expected, you know, in ceremony and conversation. There's never, I never feel a pressure to see things in a, you know, in that way. So
it's interesting because I think for a long time, so many of us were coming to terms with our own sync practices.
Right.
And Jake's practice was so inspiring that it seemed like synchromysticism was mutually exclusive with watching a lot of films.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be everyone's sync practice.
Right.
Because his sync practice totally changed. You know, pretty soon he was really caught up in this idea of the day in terms of actors' birthdays and what was going on historically in
right.
the now, which was interesting too. I thought, you know, it was funny when he did that. I think a lot of people were like, what's wrong with Jake? Why is he? I mean, as an artist, he was moving on to his next thing,
right?
And which is fascinating to me. Another artist, now that I think of it, Mark Golding. Are you familiar with his work at all?
No, I'm not.
He does these. Oh. He did the mandala that was on the cover of Sync Book 2, but he makes mandalas every day. He's got a really interesting vocabulary of imagery, and he's doing, you know, essentially the same things every day, but every day it's different.
Right.
Every day it's like this different.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, because that's. I have a sketchbook of mandalas. I was trying to integrate that into my practice because it kind of, when I sit and make a mandala, it really. You can start to get into that channel, that creative flow, and it makes it facing the white page of whatever project I'm doing a little easier because it kind of starts that flow. But yeah, once I started to use Vipassana meditation as a practice, I kind of lean more towards that. So I come up and before I start, you know, if I'm working on facing that white page and seeing what ideas are going to come, I like to start off with a Vipassana meditation before I have my meditation cushion up in my studio. So just do that first and then.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. What is that specifically and how is that different from other forms of meditation?
Well, the way I understand it, other meditations seem to have a focus on a mantra or on an image or something, or whatever it is that you can focus on to sort of get rid of all the outside thoughts. I'm not entirely sure how other systems work, and maybe I'm wrong, but Vipassana is a kind of insight meditation. So you're focusing simply on your breath and body sensations. You don't, any thoughts that come in that are distracting in any way, you just let them go and focus on your breath. And then you start to realize, I mean, I remember the breakthrough moment for me when I took this course, which is, it's 10 days of silence, right? So you're meditating for like 13 hours a day for 10 days. And it's really like meditation boot camp. But it was something that I was really facing, like anger issues, and to have, especially the, not to understand the technique for the first few days was difficult sitting there, and I wanted to leave and they don't let you go. And I was just like, you know, angry. And then this anger came up and you realize that it's like the sensations hit your body before the reaction. So if you can kind of get in between the sensation and the reaction, you can chill out and not have, you know, whether it's, you know, whatever your issue is with facing life, I guess it's Vipassana kind of gives you that step back to kind of see it coming before it comes and just chill out. So I don't know if that's a good way to explain it, but there's a lot of information online about it, and I love it because it's simply clearing the mind of any distraction, and then you're really just kind of, the cosmos speaks to you rather than focusing on.
Well, I was happy that we were going to talk to you because one of the things that I really wanted to like think about and discuss is this idea of the difference between, say, a scientific practice, a mystical practice, or an artistic practice, and where they overlap and where they're different.
Right.
Can you speak to that a little bit?
I don't know how well I can speak to it, but it's interesting. Like I recently listened to the episode that you guys had with Alex Sakaris, and I love his Skeptico podcast and his approach to things because it allows for some rationality, but also the mystical side of it. Like trying to integrate those two, because I kind of find that science, religion, art, all of these things kind of, when you're, are kind of leading to the same source, but they just don't agree in the way that it's articulated, or how, you know, and I think there's a lot of sort of arguments between those things that are not really important. But I'm not sure how much science comes into my approach, but I'm definitely always take a step back to be sure that what I'm practicing or doing has sort of some scientific rationality in it too, so I don't get completely lost just become sort of airy about it and not.
Well, I sometimes wonder if it isn't intention that the tool, let's say, call those three things like the tool. There's a different intention behind each.
Yeah.
What do you think? What is the intention of your art?
Well, see, that's an interesting question. How when I came back from Los Angeles, my art was very kind of angry, and I had a lot, you know, taking out your teenage and early 20s angst in my art. And when I started to show it in galleries, I realized that the people who were attracted to it and were talking to me about it had issues too. And I was kind of using my art to purge those things and get rid of them. But I found that once they were out and on the wall, they were attracting others who had that could validate their negativity through that or something, you know. And so when I came back to my first ayahuasca ceremony, I actually trucked up my whole art portfolio in like 10 kilometers into the bush to do this ceremony, because I just felt like I needed to purify my art process, because I didn't like the way it was resonating like with the world. And now I think that I'm sort of in this transition where I'm trying to put out artwork that has a positive resonance with others, but my style doesn't really lend to that so well, because I kind of have a graphic sort of edge to it. I don't know, kind of comic bookish or something, but so I think my intention with my artwork now is to try to just almost, I don't know, in a way almost make up for the art I've put out there in the past, because I love that. I mean, it's kind of like a journaling experience for me. It's where I was at. I don't regret any of the artwork I've done in the past at all, but I'm definitely have a different intention creatively too.
How do you think that ayahuasca has changed your style, or have you had a relationship with ayahuasca now?
Yeah, I do. And I think that I try to do it at least once a year, maybe once or twice a year, but just to sort of get me back to it, it's definitely helped me. I mean, when it was through an ayahuasca ceremony where I was able to have that understanding that what I needed to do was put sort of more positive vibes into my work, like rather than thinking I could purge out the negative and then somehow accumulate positive outcome from my work. If I put out where I wanted to go with my work, like put what I would like to achieve with my work, if I put that into my work, then I could get to that end instead of. So yeah, I don't know. Ayahuasca has definitely helped me a lot with my art, and it's the reason why I revisit it all the time, to sort of hit that reset button and get back to sort of just the creative flow without the distraction that I start for myself.
Now, you may not be too much into Hollywood anymore, but I would definitely call you a synchromistic, because it's obvious that you use like synchromistic.
That's so funny, Willie.
Wait, let me finish.
So in Will, you hear this in Will's mind, synchromisticism and Hollywood.
It doesn't have.
Are mutually exclusive?
No, they are not. Okay. They are not. Because that's my point. But basically what it is reinterpreting myth, and I consider movies myth. So there's no difference between like myth, you know, the stories of Jesus or the Bible and Hollywood. They have the same impact. In fact, movies probably have a bigger impact on consciousness now than they did then. And, you know, when you go to the movies, it's like going to – it is like going to church. I mean – almost any religion all talk about movies. Like I can be in my break room at work where there's like the United Nations up in that piece and everybody can talk about the movies that happened and how much money that movie made. But what I'm getting back on point, Douglas, what I was bringing up were entries in your blog like what in Jesus's name is the crown of thorns, or the other one that you did about Kronos. I mean, these are synchromystic reinterpretations of myths based off your own experiences, if you get
absolutely.
What I'm saying. Yeah,
no, and I totally agree with what you said there. Just because the Hollywood approach to synchromysticism doesn't work for me, that's just because of my experience, right? Like, but I think it's absolutely valid, and I support it like through and through because for that exact same reason that you just illustrated, how I think that the myths, however they're articulated and interpreted in different ways over time or in different nations, all lead to the same source. It's when you argue over whether this myth is better than that, that you're not really getting the point or something. That's how I feel. And so, yeah, that reinterpretation is exactly how I see Hollywood as. And that's important and valid for sure.
What in Jesus' name is the crown of thorns?
Well, this is something that when I have out here, one of the good things about living out in the middle of nowhere is I have a friend who's a historian and a journalist for a long time. And when I take my mythological, what I learned from that, and I go to talk to a historian, he can put it in a different, give me a different angle at it. And he started to talk to me about Roman military practice and how the different decorations in the military army. And he's like, maybe you should look into how those crowns were, how crowns were in the Roman military. So I started to look into that and found that, and comparing it with the verses in the Bible that speak of Jesus' crown of thorns, it specifically points out that the whole company of soldiers is called to him when they grab these thorns and make this makeshift crown. And a lot of the, you know, sort of the pulpit commentaries on that talk about how that's just, you know, they're mocking him as a king. It was mocking the gold crowns that kings wore. But the highest awarded crown, or the one with the highest honor, was actually made on the spot at a place where somebody made a decision that saved an entire army. And so this is what I see going on in that story, is that they specifically say in Mark and Matthew that like the whole company of soldiers was gathered, and then they build this crown and they put it on his head. And so I see there's another layer to that, rather than just like, oh, the Romans were torturing them. They're also, as a Roman reader, I mean, these are written in Greek, and for a Roman audience, you don't want to see your own countrymen doing this to the protagonist. Like, what's going on? But if it has the weight of also having an underlining meaning that it's like this high honor of this grass crown being placed on his head, which is, it's called a grass crown, but it was made from whatever vegetation was on where the battle took place, then I think there's that, it puts some weight to the story. And so that's my interpretation of the crown of thorns. And I think it's like a lot of the things I study with, I'm really into early Christianity and Gnosticism, those sorts of things right now. And I just think there's so many misinterpretations, you know.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I'm actually kind of into a book too, that, Jesus ends up being more of a political figure, a revolutionary instead of, and that's what I'm really interested in, how a divine revelation ends up becoming a religion. But let's talk about this in context back of the science, mysticism, arts shift. And so From my point of view, it seems like what those tools are seeking. So like science seeks to understand something.
Right.
Mysticism via myth ends up trying to explain something via story. And art is more of this having a relationship with something. The art itself is the result of having a relationship with something. And so instead of, you know, it's more of just an exploration. Like good art seems to be, there's no answer, there's no intention, it's just the result. It's almost like the shell cast from the organism that has a relationship with something. But so with that in mind, you know, how does that divine revelation that the scientist, the artist, or the mystic receive, how does that become a religion? What do you think about that?
That's a good question, but I think that, I don't know, I kind of look at religion as, I mean, everybody has their own personal sort of spiritual intentions and path and journey, and I think that religion is just a way, kind of the group therapy towards, you know, like getting together and having that common thread that binds you, but then, so I don't know, I see a point with religion. I always find that I kind of, I don't know, maybe I have more of a existentialist sort of take on things, where any sort of structured system I kind of reject on its face, and I don't really allow for it because I'm constantly reinterpreting the myth, and I don't want to commit to just one because I don't know, my journey just sort of takes me in different directions. And I think that if you sort of see that stream going through, like sort of that common thread, that collective unconscious sort of thing that's going on with all myths and religions that point to it, then I don't really see the necessity in binding yourself to one stream of thought or religion, because I think that's where problems come in. But
is there anything arising? And so it's interesting, when we talk to you, it sounds like your art practice is partially also your meditation practice, your sync practice, your ayahuasca practice. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Yeah. I do think that like I wanted to be like an animator or do comics or something in the very beginning when I was younger. And I ended up on the streets in the West Coast for a short time. And I remember writing in my journal one night, and this guy just came out of nowhere. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was under a street lamp. And I'm nervous as he's approaching me. And he just came to me and he said, be careful what you write, because you don't know who's going to read it or what they're going to do. And he walked away. That's all he came to tell me. And, you know, my heart's racing. But from that moment, I started to think my creation should be my art. So I started to use different sort of like symbolisms and sort of, it was almost like journal entries for me. But I didn't want them to read the words. They could kind of, you know, the viewer of my work could see where I was at through how it expressed itself in a painting. And that's when I started doing paintings and stuff. And yeah, I think that even now, all of my meditation, ayahuasca, everything I experience in life, being a father, husband, goes into the result is art. And that's what I'm sort of creating and putting out there for others. And I think that the message in there should be one that sort of inspires us to keep going, rather than reflect sort of the negative aspects of the human experience.
Sometimes the negative does come out, though, which is interesting, because so one of my little lenses is this idea that we're kind of marching through the tarot with these years, and since 15th is the devil card, that there's a bit of a shadow dance this year.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering, I mean, that's definitely arising for me lately. I'm seeing the shadow. Mm-hmm. We've been watching a lot of Lord of the Rings, and it's just this marching towards. My son is obsessed right now. What's arising in your sync web, Darcy?
Well, right now, I'm really focused on early Christianity and stuff, right? So, but it's interesting because what I'm putting together for like my next art like I want to, I'm working on a full exhibit, and it's to do with Judas. And because I think Judas's story is also another thing that's been, you know, horribly misinterpreted. And so it's, but so I always kind of tend towards the bad guy, I definitely have, there's like a reverence for, and I understand that the dark is a part of it, right? So even when I'm putting out something positive in my work, it doesn't look like it sometimes, because I put the, you know, use the skull or this weird biological chords and stuff going on in my work, because, and that I find is disturbing, even when the message is, in my mind, it's a positive thing, but it comes across as a disturbing image, and it's and I'm okay with that, because I do think that people need to face their, you know, not just, it's not all about being, you know, positive and manifesting the positive in your life. Well, that's going to happen by facing the negative, right? And it's a balance. I'm not one of these. I'm not really into the idea of us all being, everything being one. I do think that the earthly, or this experience for us as humans, is sort of a university of duality. Duality exists, and I think that it's something that needs to be approached and learned from in this sort of incarnation of our whatever, our spiritual.
Okay, that's interesting. So, I mean, I just went through this whole big musical experience, and what I came out with this relationship to the transcendent, you know, like what we're seeking out of experiences sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, so what is your relationship to the divine? You kind of touched on it there.
I don't know. It's something I don't think I could articulate too well, because I'm sort of in the, it's just, it's ever, I just know that whatever it is now won't be, I'm really learning. I'm kind of in an early stage of it. And I go through different phases as I go through it. But I guess my relationship with the divine my first ayahuasca ceremony that sort of really was very art, and my process like focused on that. A lot of messages came through. It was like that I am a creator in the same way that, like, you know, if there's, I don't know how to really explain it too well, but it's sort of almost like if we each have sort of a divine spark within us, then it's my responsibility to create something that, you know, people would want to live in. If it's like, I don't know.
No, I'm kind of lost. I'm following,
like,
you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I just don't, you know, if you look at it like the way God created the earth and that sort of like mythological look at things like that, it's like, there might be a lot of bad things going on here on planet Earth, but, you know, look at the trees, look at there's a lot of beauty in it. And, you know, luckily it wasn't just created as a big, you know, sewer. It's like, so I think that
So you're fairly hopeful then?
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm hopeful, but I'm okay with, if my role here as an artist is, I don't think that my art is ever going to look completely hopeful, because I think my responsibility is to kind of remind people that there is a dark side too. And it's not going to go away. I think it's detrimental to a spiritual journey to just focus on the positive. And I mean, I don't know. I see a lot of sort of imbalance that comes from just focusing on the light. You know, the dark needs to sort of be represented too. And I think my art, no matter what the message is in it, will always have some dark imagery in it. So.
All right, so I'm keying in on the dream here. The dream of being an animator and an illustrator is what took you to LA, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what was it that inspired you to follow that dream, and why? What exactly crushed it?
Well, I think as far as the animation aspect of it was kind of crushed before Los Angeles had anything to do with it, just because I had done animation and it's just too monotonous for me. It was kind of taking away from I'd like to create the characters and stuff like that, but to sit there and animate them, really, no, it's not my thing. So I wasn't sure. I kind of reevaluated that childhood dream pretty early on. But I think what LA did for me to crush it even further was just I think that the sort of the suits there they're just preying on this creative energy that others have there, whether it's an actor, a singer, an artist, a writer, whatever it is. It's like, I don't think they're appreciating the creative process. They're like sort of, it's a shark tank and it's like, yeah, I just don't.
Predatory.
I'm not interested in that. Yeah. I want to be able to create something and have people that appreciate it in my community, not people who are looking for an opportunity to exploit it, you know?
Yeah. But that's fascinating because so in my recent look at Jesus, it's this idea of empire, and empire goes back, you know, to basically when we started farming. We needed a system to produce results, and what happens is it becomes a system of exploitation, where culture is kind of this product of the it's almost like we created the beauty that we have is a result of exploiting other people. It's like, right, to give people enough free time to think about certain things. But what's so fascinating in terms of that is Jesus's message was there's no compromise. You know, right, we can't exploit anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, this is where my thoughts are right now, is how do we dismantle our political structures to create a world where the darkness, we aren't making the darkness.
Right. Yeah. I don't have the answer for that, but that's sort of what my
do you think it's possible?
I hope it is, but again, I'm just not too sure whether it's ever supposed to happen in this realm of this earthly experience. I don't know. I feel like if we're just spirits passing by and this is our stop, then this is like, I like that idea of that university of duality. It's always going to exist here, I think. And then maybe we can transcend that afterwards if there is, you know, something beyond this, but I'm not sure that, because I mean, again, I get this perspective from my historian friend as well. Like, there's always been these struggles. They're no different just because it seemed like they're intensifying as technology marches on and you know, the things get more and more corrupt. But this is sort of, I think there's always this. So I'm not sure if Earth, if we have, if there's a chance of always flowing in like this redemption or whatever, but I think that while I'm here, it's worth trying. I want to be able to like create in that vein, at least sort of, you know, not just give into the idea of it. Like, yeah, I definitely have hope that it could happen. I'm just not entirely sure I believe it's going to.
That was 42 minutes. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
You've been listening to Darcy J. Watt on Sync Book Radio, production of thesyncbook.com. Information about the work of Mr. Watt can be found at darcyjwatt.com. For more information about the Sync Book, our guest, to check out past shows, to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at 42minutes.com. If you like this podcast and would like more, consider becoming a member. Some of the membership benefits include full access to the complete audio archives, discounts on books, behind-the-scenes scripts, bonus audio and video, as well as monthly online hangouts with the host. All this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com/membership. Thanks so much. And do anything but let it produce joy. Do anything but let it yield ecstasy.
Oh, make me over. I'm all I wanna be. A walking study. Look at my face. My name is Mighty Beyond. My name is never.